Welcome, everyone. I am Bob Wurzelbacher, the director of the Respect Life Office for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and this is our video podcast series that we call Being Pro-Life. Each month, we discuss a different topic in the Respect Life arena. We'll hear a personal story from someone deeply affected by that issue, and finally, we'll share some ways that you can get involved. Today's guest is a family law attorney, adoptee, and mother of five children, international pro-life speaker, Rebecca Kiesling. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Rebecca, I heard you share your personal witness at a banquet in the fall of 2023, and that's why I invited you on this podcast. You shared some personal witnesses to perhaps help people rethink their opinions about rape exceptions on abortion legislation. Anyone is welcome to listen to this podcast, of course, but most of our regular listeners are against abortion, at least in most circumstances. But a commonly used exception for many people is reasons of rape or incest. So how would we begin by you just sharing your story and help us perhaps rethink those?
I was adopted, and I learned at 18 that I was conceived in rape. I learned the details at 19 when I met my birth mother, who wanted to meet me. She told me that she had been abducted at knife point by a serial rapist, and later shared that she actually went to two illegal abortions, and I was almost aborted. But the conditions and the fact that it was illegal caused her to back out, as it did with most women. And when I asked her about abortion, she told me after we met that if abortion had been legal, she would have aborted me. And even if she had to do it all over again, she maintained that position for the next 6 years. So I literally owe my birth to the Michigan law, which protected me. She sought to abort me exactly 4 years before Roe v. Wade.
Well, you must have been going through so much just hearing, you know, suddenly hearing that and processing this and trying to figure out what this all means about your, even your value of your life. Want to tell us a little bit about that turmoil that was going on inside over all this information?
I definitely had years where growing up, even that I struggled with issues of value, identity, and purpose. I had been adopted and raised in a secular Jewish home. I went to 5 years of Hebrew school, 3 days a week. I was bat mitzvah and everything, but God was irrelevant in our household. And I empathized for all the family members who they lost in the Holocaust, but I didn't feel like those were my people. And I thought, you know, I want to find my roots. The miniseries Roots from Alex Haley was very... had an impact on me, like so many Americans at the time. And I wanted to find my roots. My parents told me this fiction that, oh, your birth mother loved you so much that she chose adoption. I mean, they didn't really know that.
Right.
And my adoption story was very much infertility centered, that I was there to make them whole. There was no big picture worldview of that answered the question of who am I, why am I here, what is my value, identity, and purpose.
What made your adoptive mother feel like she wanted to share this with you now?
Well, they told me from a young age that I was adopted.
Right.
Although when I was like learning about pregnancy in early elementary school, I didn't really understand the concept of a birth mother because my parents just talked about how I was chosen and there was a room full of babies and they picked me up. And I thought pregnancy didn't apply to me, that I was adopted instead of being born, essentially, and that you were as old as you were adopted. And so I would cry to my parents, why didn't you adopt me first? Because I thought I'd be older than my brother and I could instead beat him up. So I obviously at some point I learned the concept of a birth mother, and right. My mom took me to see the musical Annie, Little Orphan Annie, in fourth grade. And I began to romanticize about this birth family that I had.
Yeah. I realize you grew up with that, but then your mother shared with you this actual story, right? That is as much as she knew about it.
Well, not my adoptive mother. She didn't know. It was through the courts.
Oh, it was through looking into your story yourself that you found out.
Yeah. Well, I was glad my birth mother wanted to meet me, but it was very painful to hear that she would have aborted me.
Right.
I wanted to know that this wasn't an issue. Because, of course, when I learned how I was conceived at 18, I thought about what people say about abortion and cases of rape. And I immediately felt targeted and devalued by our society. I knew that they were talking about me, right, about my life.
Did you only start looking into or thinking about, you know, rape exceptions with abortion after you found out that you were conceived in rape? Or had you, did you kind of grow up thinking about that and just when it didn't apply, when you didn't know it applied to you, if you will?
Abortion wasn't talked about a whole lot. My cousin had one when I was 12. She was 16. She actually aborted my grandmother's first great-grandchild. And it was 2 years later that my grandfather died and my grandmother began to tell the story that when she was pregnant with my aunt, who's the younger of her two children, she was the mother of that cousin who aborted. My grandfather had told my grandmother to go get an abortion, to abort my aunt. And my grandmother, for years, would share the story and she'd cry and she'd say, I never loved him again after that. How could they do that? How could they kill the babies? So I had a faith to the issue. And then in high school, we studied this issue and my classmates brought in photos of aborted babies and I was mortified.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, I just won't have one.
Right.
Didn't really affect my life. I never contemplated that abortion pertained to me.
Right.
Because I always just heard, well, in cases of rape, like that was sort of the one reason.
That it might be okay.
Well, that's what people would say.
Right. Right. Now you're dealing with all this. And so now just carry on with your, what were you doing in life? And then you're meeting your birth mother and what happened from there?
I went to college out of state. I was struggling in life. I ended up in abusive relationships and eventually lost my front tooth. My smell was restored as part of the Give Back a Smell program for victims of domestic violence. And I, you know, ended up in church and came to know my value, identity, and purpose in Christ.
Do you want to share a little bit about that conversion story?
I had first come to know Christ when I was 15, and then I felt forsaken by my church friends after about 9 months and no longer had a ride. And so it wasn't until I'd made some terrible decisions in my life. I went through the most difficult years of my life, like as a young person, making bad choices.
Okay.
And all it took was one person who invited me to church and then shared their faith with me. And I gave my heart back over to Christ. I remember them singing Amazing Grace. And I was at that point no longer dealing with what had been done to me, but what I had done to hurt myself, to hurt God, to hurt others.
Right. So you were how old then?
I was 23.
Okay. Well, continue with the story then. So where have you gone then with this self-discovery of your belief and what it is that you felt called to do in life, which is where you are now?
About 6 years after meeting her, my birth mother changed her mind about abortion. She was making baby clothes for my niece in Florida, who was in an unplanned teen pregnancy with my birth mother's first great-grandchild. And she said, I'm really glad she decided to have this baby, and I've changed my mind about all that.
Wow.
And then Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe, from right. Roe v. Wade, came out with the same thing, that she had changed her mind about abortion.
So then what led you to where you are now, deciding to come out and speak about it? Let's go through the whole history there.
I took tons of public speaking as a kid, knowing I wanted to be a lawyer since the age of 10. I thought to be a good lawyer, you have to be a good speaker and up on your feet. I had acting classes in college, acting for television. I lead role in two college plays. I just thought all this is going to help me to be a good attorney. And then I ended up being a speaker. I am a family law attorney, but I specialize in terminating parental rights of rapists. But primarily, I just share my story around the state, around the country.
Were you sharing your story while you were going through law school, or you became a lawyer and a family law first, and then you started doing more speaking engagements after that?
Well, I gave a little speech my very first semester in college.
Okay.
On adoption. And then it was actually some poetry I wrote. And then, as a recent, new attorney, I started speaking. First speaking on behalf of the local pregnancy center and briefly telling my story. And then I started getting more and more invites.
All right. Well, when we think about rape exceptions, what I've just practically speaking, I've always wondered when people put rape exceptions in law, what would that mean, right? Would the woman be required to go through a trial, right, and have a man convicted of rape before she would qualify for the rape exception? That seems very impractical because that takes a lot of time. Would she simply have to accuse someone? Would she just have to say she was raped without putting a name down? Who does she have to report it to? These practical questions come to mind. And if on the one hand, some of them seem like, even if you're for rape exceptions, they might seem a little bit too, like you're asking too much of the woman to have that exception if you've actually been raped. On the other hand, if you don't have any requirements and all you have to do is say, I was raped, then that's a meaningless exception. Then you can get that abortion really for any reason, whether you were raped or not. What is your knowledge of how that actually works in practice with states that have exceptions or how they work or don't work, even when they're in place?
Almost every state that has exceptions or, you know, federal government, there's no teeth to it at all. You just wink, wink, say rape, report it. Even doesn't say who has to report it. Even the clinic work can report it. It's not real.
Is that ever talked about even in legislation? Like, hey, if somebody was okay with a rape exception, as long as there was some kind of a requirement, some level of accountability, so it's not just a box that you have to check. Have you been in discussions like that where people have tried to work with some kind of a requirement, or it's just...
There just shouldn't be rape exceptions.
I mean, I realize that's our... Right.
And you would never do that. For, you know, in the Me Too day and age, for a woman to be able to accuse a man of rape and all she has to do is say rape, and it would be lawful for her to hire a hitman to have him killed or just her innocent child.
That is such an interesting thing that obviously people never think about. Of course not. Of course not. Right. And yet that's a reason. And that's a reason we're only claiming, right, to have an abortion for your innocent child. I remember when you were speaking at the banquet I was referring to last fall, you had a lot to say. Just, you know, but if someone's thinking, well, rape, it seems like a good enough reason because you don't want to traumatize the woman by making them have a child that they didn't have anything to do with. Just want you to share why, what's wrong with that thinking, right? Why is it that people should rethink, oh, how it's just too traumatizing to make a woman go through pregnancy if she's been raped?
First of all, it's barbaric to punish an innocent child for someone else's crime. Right. In a civilized society, we don't do that. And the U.S. Supreme Court in Coker v. Georgia, I'm an attorney, so I'll get all legalese, but they said that rapists don't deserve the death penalty. And in the second case of Kennedy v. Louisiana, they said that even for child molesters, it's cruel and unusual punishment. So how does an innocent child deserve to die for his crime?
Right.
And then it's also absurd to think that more violence in the exact spot where she was traumatized will bring healing. No, it does not. But a baby does have a way of bringing healing.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Baby would bring. I know people say a lot of times, when at least in the hypothetical, they will say, oh, every time you look at that child's face, you know, you'd be reminded of that horrific moment. Are you aware of women? You probably are. Who have had the absolute opposite experience. They might have feared that looking in that child's face would bring trauma, whereas instead, of course, it brought the opposite.
Yeah, and rape victims, they actually abort at half the rate of your average unplanned pregnancy. And what they express is that the baby is innocent, is just as innocent as they were, and that the baby was able to bring them healing during their time of suffering, where they had vowed never to tell another soul. Now they're able to actually get healing. They see the child as being a co-victim, and they go to family and friends to tell them now what happened instead of just burying the rape. So they're able to get the counseling that they never would have otherwise received.
Right. That makes sense.
And they talk about how my child was innocent. My child was just as innocent as I was.
You probably must hear this one a lot too, because I know a lot of people who would say, I'm personally against rape. Sounds like another argument as well. But anyway, personally against rape exceptions. But if that's what it takes to get someone on the other side of the table to agree to more abortion restriction, it's better to accept that exception than to throw away the possibility of any abortion restriction. What do you think about that argument, right, for accepting a rape exception?
So I'm from Michigan, where we never had a single rape exception, a single law. And that's because of policy of your local pro-life organization. So Right to Life in Michigan was part of the movement and the schism at the beginning of the pro-life movement, really early 70s.
Okay.
They said, we're not going to engage in child sacrifice, because that's what it is. As soon as you're willing to sacrifice, as we always hear, the one exchange for the 99, like I always think of the parable of the lost sheep, because Jesus said, see that you do not despise any of these little ones. For I tell you, their angels in heaven always look upon the face of my Father in heaven. And it goes right into the parable of the lost sheep, how the good shepherd leaves the 99 to save the one. And he explains its point by saying, for in the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should perish, and neither should we. So at risk, he was talking about little ones who are despised, who are at risk of being killed, and he's not willing that any should perish. When you do that, you're engaging in child sacrifice, and it is an abomination.
Now, do you feel the same way when it comes, let's say, for example, right? But let's say abortion is legal somewhere in a particular place up until birth. And then you're at the table and they say, hey, I'm willing to sign a legislation that limits it to 15 weeks. Now, of course, I'm not for abortion at 14 weeks or 13 weeks or 12 weeks or 6 weeks. But should I say, okay, I'll agree with you on that to get that, even though I would love to have a lot more? Or is that sacrificing the people who are less than 15 weeks old? Where do you stand on something like that?
Well, I think that there's a difference between discriminating against a people group, because, you know, being 15 weeks gestationally is not like lifelong. You know, it's a temporary situation and you're not targeting like a people group.
Right.
Whereas with rape and incest, you're systematically targeting a people group for annihilation.
So there's the difference. So you could see coming to a table and saying, hey, if this is all you'll give me is some kind of a timeline, I'll take it rather than nothing. But on the other hand, putting in an exception for people that are just as valuable as any other person, like a rape exception, any reason kind of thing, that's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Right. Is there a website, you know, that you'd like to point people to learn more about your story or more about what you do?
Yes. So mine is RebeccaKiesling.com, and that's RebeccaKiesling.com. And then Save the Ones is, I mean, the numeral one, not the word. So SaveTheOne.com. And we have lots of great resources.
Well, here's the site, RebeccaKiesling.com. Well, let's go to that other one then too. Save the number one?
Yes.
.com. There we go. Those are the two sites. I can see you on here as well. What can we find on these sites that you want to point out to people?
On Save the One, there's a number of videos. Those are great for sharing on social media. We have memes on our Facebook page. We have lots of great memes. And then we have hundreds of blogs with different stories. So you can click on the right, like if you want to see a story about pregnant by rape, incest, you know, we have those stories. Or Trisomy 18, we have those stories. So you can go by topic and find any stories about like being conceived in rape. Like we have some position papers, all kinds of stuff there. We have a lot of great writers.
Excellent. And then back on the Rebecca Kiesling page, what's on this page?
I have my story and then, you know, my bio, and I have, I think there's also some videos, and there's also my story translated into like a couple dozen different languages. And any of that, again, is good for sharing.
All right. Terrific.
It's also got the story of how I changed the heart of Governor Rick Perry during his presidential campaign.
Okay, great. Is there anything else you want to share? Because I mean, you know, people are hearing us or perhaps rethinking. So any, if people are feel like maybe they're more on the fence now, having heard some of your stories, or anything else you want to share that would help people go, okay, this is why rape and incest, for that matter, exceptions are wrong. And we really shouldn't be talking about them. We really shouldn't be trying to use those.
Another argument is that this is an equal protection issue. You know, you can't say you believe in the right to life. You know, where does it come from? The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deprive a person of their right to life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And no state shall deny a person equal protection of the laws. I'm a person. So when you add a rape exception, you're denying due process. You're going to deprive me of my right to life without due process. And you're going to deny me equal protection of the laws. So that's completely discriminatory. What you're doing is you're discriminating against an entire people group of innocents.
Right.
And we are not pawns. We're not bargaining chips. We're not cannon fodder that you just get to stick our people group out on the front line and take a giant step back and just let us be slaughtered. That's completely immoral. That is child sacrifice. And it's an abomination.
Right. So, Rebecca, I know that when people think about rape exceptions, they think that what they're doing is protecting the woman who has been raped from having a second violent act. But in reality, you're violating them a second time and instead protecting the rapist. Lead us through that. Why is it that that's the case?
It destroys evidence. We know that abortion clinics rarely report the rape. And so you're just protecting and enabling them to continue perpetrating. The abortion clinic is the sex trafficker and child molester's best friend. They need them to continue perpetrating. Oftentimes, if you look at the hashtag rapist love abortion, you'll see all these documented cases where there were repeated abortions and they continued to rape the minor child. Mm. And it just protected them, didn't protect the girl. When the girl gives birth, the baby is the one who protects her.
I'm sure that's particularly true that if obviously, you don't have to have anybody accused of rape in order to have that rape exception. So the rapist is completely getting off by having the abortion done on the woman.
Right.
All right. Well, anything else that we have left out that you feel like I need to ask you or you want to share about this topic?
No, I just really appreciate it. You know, our people group, we're just as worthy of love and life as anyone else. With Save the One, we have a global network of over 1,200 who were conceived in rape like me and mothers who became pregnant by rape or sex trafficking or incest. And then also hundreds who were told by doctors to abort. And we're not the hard cases. The hard cases are all people with the hard heart who are the tough nuts to crack. But we are just as worthy of love and life as anyone else.
Well, Rebecca, if most of us don't sit across the table and are involved in any of these negotiations, if you will, about what should, you know, legislation related to abortion, what advice do you give to the regular person that's sitting, listening at home? Can they, and if so, how can they get involved in this topic of ending rape and incest exceptions for abortion?
Well, you know, go to Save the One's website, read our pieces. We have a lot of policy pieces on it. You know, read our stories, start sharing our stuff, you know, on Facebook. We have lots of great videos as well and posts. That helps just to start raising awareness.
Right.
But we have a 5-state study that was commissioned. Several pro-life organizations went in on it. It's the only one ever done on what about rape. And people were surveyed in a 1-hour interactive online study. They got paid to do it. And they were surveyed at the beginning, halfway through, at the end. And we could dramatically sway people's opinion on this issue. It's actually really easy, especially with people who are pro-life with exceptions. They're 99% of the way there. They are our allies, you know, and we find that it's very easy to change their hearts when you put a face to the issue and just take the time to enlighten them.
All right. Well, thank you, Rebecca, for coming on the show to share that personal witness for the work that you do to use your own story to advocate for the most innocent among us. And I pray that this may actually touch some people's hearts and have them rethink some of their perhaps default positions that they may have. So thank you, Rebecca, for coming on the show.
Okay. Thanks so much.
And I want to thank all of our viewers and listeners for tuning in on this episode of our Being Pro-Life series. Head to the website to view all the links talked about in this episode at www.catholicaoc.org/beingprolife. Thank you again for joining us today. I look forward to being with you next time.